welcome to Worlds Apart. A year ago, after the fall of the Assad government, Syria seemed well poised for a new beginning. With Russia and Iran out and Turkey and Saudi Arabia squarely in, the path forward seemed unobstructed and fairly clear. That is until the US-Israeli attack on Iran and its asymmetrical response threw the whole region off balance. Which road is Damascus likely to take next? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Amar Kaf, Executive Director of the Omran Center of Strategic Studies in Syria. It's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for this time. Now, any revolution is usually accompanied by high hopes, sometimes unrealistically high hopes, and new authorities usually pretty quickly discover that using power, exercising power, is far more challenging than fighting for it. How do you think the new Syrian authorities fare in this regard?
Well, I mean, you can say that there was a practice period during the last 10 years in Idlib, North Syria, Northeast. In many of those areas, they practice governance, they practice public service delivery. Yes, it's definitely not the same scale as managing the capital in Damascus, but it was a trial. It was a way to build capacities of people. And I think that's the number one, is that you need individual capacities of people, and you need to manage expectations. And I think that's something that they are more cautious about, to send the right messages, to set the right expectations for people. It's a very difficult route. It's not easy, and it will require at least a minimum of 5 years to stabilize the situation. So I think it's a mix of many areas of work. One is building new capacities of people, fixing institutions, fixing laws, fixing the entire ecosystem and the broken system that's been going on for not just 12 years, but actually the last 50 years. It was not a functioning country. It was not a country that works good with its neighbors, not a country that works good with its citizens. And the new authorities are gradually building a new momentum.
As we just mentioned, the transition was very, very fast from urban warfare to managing one province to now running the whole country and representing it on the international stage. What are some of the areas of skills or expertise that you think are now in the sort of the highest demand of being developed?
Well, I mean, it's all types of individuals, all types of skill sets that are needed. Gradually, the Syrian state is attracting, is pulling in expertise from the diaspora, expertise from people who left 30 years ago or left 10 years ago, to you know, the aviation, the investment world, the legal world, the external relations, the public relations. You know, all of these require. Even humanitarian diplomacy as well, that requires a collaborative effort and requires a new set of skills when you really cannot afford to pay them good salaries. So you're also looking for people who at least can sustain themselves in the current period, yet they have the right skills to take Syria in a quick and fast way towards recovery.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are critics who say that President Ahmed al-Sharaa presents to the outside world a very polished, westernized persona, but his governance inside Syria isn't that slick, consistent, or comprehensive. What would you say to those kind of criticisms?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think he presents not a Western approach, but a Syrian approach. A Syrian approach that is agile, that is fluid, that is still experimental, and is very careful not to make very decisive decisions and very firm decisions, because the situation is very fragile and Syrian communities across Syria are still not united. And so he's been trying, I think, stepping on his toes to be careful not to incite any ticking bombs that are within the country, and there are plenty of them. I mean, we all saw the issue with Sueda and Israel intervening, you know, swiftly, with a few minutes, if not a few hours. And so I think there is a careful approach by the new president to make sure that we don't repeat mistakes and that we learn fast, and that if individuals do not perform well, they have to be replaced immediately. And that has been practiced for the last year and a half.
Now, I spent a lot of time in Syria in the beginning of the Arab Spring, and at that time there were a lot of attacks on Syrian civil servants for their alleged association with the so-called Assad regime. And frankly speaking, there were such a phenomenon of targeting non-political state employees was happening all across the region. I wonder how the new authorities go about it. Do they value the expertise or the skills offered by those people who, whether you like it or not, have sustained whatever was present of the Syrian state over the last couple of years and probably even decades? I'm talking about, medical doctors, I'm talking about traffic officers, clerks, bureaucrats, those people who do not necessarily represent the ideology, but ensure that, basic services are run to, the best possible ability in the given circumstances.
Well, I mean, those individuals, of course, not all of them are bad. And this is not about whether those civil servants are good or bad. Some of them were definitely very bad, even civil servants, even professors at universities. There are plenty of individuals, civil servants, that have committed atrocities indirectly. They have led to the arrest and the torture and the killing of thousands of prisoners. And so some of those are still, in their job. The new government realizes that not everybody that stayed in Damascus is a bad person. But at the same time, if you need fast recovery, you need innovative approaches. You need to really find out what is the real law and change the law, or at least to pause the law. Unfortunately, those individuals, even the good ones and the good-hearted ones, they are not good for this phase. They're no good to be innovative. Of course, there are some good people. Again, the majority are good individuals.
With all due respect, Mr. Kaff, when you are cleaning the streets or fixing the sewage system, perhaps you do not always have to be innovative, but you just need to make sure that things are run and that, bread is baked, that medical services are provided. I'm not arguing with you. I just want to get
a
sense
from
you.
Let me tell you about medical. I mean, look at the work of the new Minister of Health, going from clinic to clinic and hospital to hospital, managing the hidden corruption within these many of the old staff. Yes, they know how to turn on the machine, but do they use it efficiently? Do they treat people with dignity? Do they allow, and the minister has been shifting people around, trying to be as adaptive and as welcoming to all employees, regardless of their political, ideological, etc. But they really were not providing services in the last 12 years. They were systematically preventing services from being delivered to all people. This is something that needs to be acknowledged. Now, do they deserve to go back home? Maybe not, but are they going to be part of the new renaissance and recovery of Syria? I'm sorry. They were part of the decline of Syria, and there's no way that they could be in the same positions. They need to be changed to other positions. They need to be adapted. They need to be helped. They cannot be left in the streets.
If we step outside those concrete personalities or, groups of people, is there anything valuable in the so-called old Syria that you think is worth being salvaging?
I mean, you cannot cut with the past. You cannot completely, assume that the past doesn't exist. It exists. And we have very limited choices of dealing with the past. There are individuals that can be salvaged. There are systems that may be salvaged. But I think the majority of laws are out of date. The majority of procedures systematically block investments, systematically block social protection, systematically block innovation. And those things have been completely structured. I mean, let me, an example, civil documents that you need to go. that the entire system has been based on how to not serve people. So how can he change the mentality of an individual who's been working for 20 years in a process that was designed to unserve people and to really treat people with less dignity by design, not by lack of resources. It was designed mentality-wise, culturally-wise, an institution with dark hallways, with shivering lights, with all these different things that cause a lot of distress to anyone who comes into the building. So a building that is wide open to customer service that helps people and is based around the service of public civilians. This is a complete shift of culture. I mean, when you talk about the Ministry of Interior talking about a people-centric approach to the delivery of security services, it's talking about that security starts at the individual civilian.
Since the takeover of by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, Syria has had some instances of ethnically motivated killings, particularly among the Alawites. In your estimation, do you think these ethnic or perhaps sectarian tensions can still be exploited or still remain an inflammable issue that could be exploited by, you know, actors both domestic and foreign?
I mean, unfortunately, yes. There's a lot of fragility in the social infrastructure. There's a lack of trust among different components. And there's a lack of economic development. And I think that's key to everything else. You know, when they say it's the economy that really moves a lot of issues and solves issues. And it's the economy that also matters to a lot of the fragile communities, whether you're talking about ethnic, religious, even physically handicapped. I mean, there's so many layers of fragile communities that need attention immediately. You're talking about people who lost their pensions, talking about people who lost their jobs, whether they were on either side, but people who need some sustenance to be able to live. Are we better off than a year ago? I think we're improving slightly, but there's more work that needs to be done on community dialogue, on building trust among different communities, creating some form of a new Syria that really stitches back these pieces. We have a lot of pieces spread out, and so we're kind of rebuilding this trust gradually. And so these instances, very unfortunate crimes and atrocities that took place, they were sometimes, you know, racially, ethnically motivated, sometimes also revenge of the past, because if you delay transitional justice mechanisms of holding people accountable, well, people are going to go and commit atrocities, unfortunately. So, and if you go at it too much, people will also commit atrocities, you know? It's kind of a balance.
Governing is a very difficult business, for sure.
It's a balancing act. You know, you need to arrest top criminals. You need to set an example that justice is there.
Mr. Kaf, what we also need right now is to take a very short break. We will be back to this conversation in a few moments. So stay tuned.
The deep state has its hands in everything. I was in the middle of it for decades. When I blew the whistle on CIA torture, the deep state turned on me. They ruined my life, took away my rights, threw me in prison, but they didn't break me. I fought back, and I still do. I'm John Kiriakou. On my show, The Deep State, I take you behind the geopolitical moves, the color revolutions, behind the politics and the politicians. We shine a light on where the deep state is hiding.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Amar Kaf, Executive Director of the Omran Center of Strategic Studies in Syria. Mr. Kaf, let's talk about new Syria, new foreign alliances, or perhaps foreign issues. I want to start with the issue of Turkey, because we are recording this interview on the sidelines of Antalya diplomatic forum, and Syrian authorities over the last couple of months have reported that they're going to incorporate the YPG forces that are considered terrorist by Turkey, but supported by the Americans, into the state structures. What do you think it means or entails in practical means? Because I know from my country's own post insurgency experience that it takes much more than trading paramilitary garb for business suits.
Well, I mean, first of all, the Syrian foreign relations took multiple phases in the last year and a half. The first has been a complete reopening of relations with all countries, meaning we started with a zero problems approach, but we're now in the second phase, which is the balancing approach, which is a more balanced approach. In the middle also, we replugged Syria into regional multilateral cooperation agreements. We try to approach all countries. I think the only one we haven't approached is Iran. But even Israel, we try to approach. You know, many countries trying to, you know, fix our water problems, our communications with Jordan, and have multiple MOUs. Try to also build relations with the U.S., the international coalition against ISIS, and try and lead the exit of every soldier, American soldier, out. I mean, this
You've
is a...
You've been very versatile.
This is a huge... And so when you talk about Turkish relations as well, I mean, rebalancing the relationship with Turkey institutionally takes time from both sides.
Yes, but what does it mean in practical terms to try to legitimize and give more political power to the forces that are considered terrorists by one of your main international backers? I mean, in practical terms, what does it mean to give more power to YPG?
Well, I mean, as an analyst, I don't represent the government, but as an analyst, at the end of the day, those are Syrian fighters. It's a new page in our history, and we're trying to look at all the alternative scenarios. The scenario of waging war is impossible and is very costly and has no purpose. At the end of the day, they are there, they represent different communities, and they had grievances, legitimate grievances of being denied citizenship, cultural rights, constitutional rights. And so the president in Syria approached them. One is guarantee them these rights and eventually being the constitution. And at the same time, trying to build trust with local communities, and a gradual but very firm and very very fast-paced approach to building good communication with the YPG and all these institutions, and integrating them. I mean, the approach of Damascus is not this is not Libya, where we are going to tolerate 2 days of or 3 days of an independent body. We're going at it very fast. And I know it's too dreamy, but we're not dreamers. We're action-oriented. There's a committee that is now following up. The Minister of Social Affairs was in Hasakah last week. Minister of Health was there. All the ministries are beginning to integrate, taking one piece at a time, trying to break it apart and then connect it back to the central government.
Whenever I hear the rhetoric of the new Syrian government, it's very sort of, again, no offenses, it's very westernized. It uses a lot of Western governing terms, but from my own experience on the ground in Syria, including among some rebel groups, I know that they don't speak this formal English bureaucratic language. So for them, I mean, their cultural ways are still perhaps not up to date to somebody who holds a PhD or even a Master of Science in Public Administration from a Western university. So what does it mean for those fighters? They're being brought into some governing capacity? They're being...
Fighters are being interviewed. They're being placed in three battalions in northeast Syria, one of them with Aleppo and three with the northeast. They're joining other forces in the same brigade as a unitary military unit, and they're being retrained. They're joining the training academies. Some of them have signed up to become in the interior ministry and the local security forces, and they will be gradually reintegrated. I mean, this is a reintegration is a complete process. It's not just a press of a button. But it's a process. And once you start the process, you know, they say it takes 21 days to change a habit. So you first change your clothes, your uniforms, but then you start changing the terminologies. You remove the yellow flag. You adopt the Syrian flag. You know, it's difficult in the beginning, but if you set the road and you can't go right, you can't go left, there's only one way, is to move forward.
Okay. Well, Mr. Koft, let me ask you one more thing about that, because it's been reported recently that the government has taken control of all the military bases previously used by the U.S. forces, particularly in the northeast of the country. And I know that the new authorities are very eager to present it as the result of their efforts to regain Syrian sovereignty. And I'm sure partially it's the case, but do you think the Americans also may have had their own motives for leaving, especially in the light of Israel's increasingly more assertive stance, both in Syria and around the region?
I mean, the American withdrawal was inevitable. It was there from the day Trump took office, and even the previous administration. There's a bipartisan approach of pulling forces from indefinite wars. And so this was a win-win from Syrian perspective.
It didn't pan out exactly to what he said when you consider the current engagement in Iran. He did not exactly deliver that.
I agree. I mean, and Syrian authorities have voiced their reservations on waging war in the Middle East. And so we haven't, like, we're not a Western-oriented country per se, although we are definitely not, you know, not towards Iran, not towards Israel. We're kind of in the middle where, as the president said, just leave us alone and let us at least rebuild our country.
Now, despite the statements and despite the militant past of the new Syrian authorities, they seem to show a lot of restraint when it comes to Israel and its continuing and expanding occupation of the Syrian land, particularly to the south of Damascus, as well as this constant, very casual, as it seems from the side, bombardment of Syrian territory. What do you think explains such a restraint?
I mean, Syrian authorities realize that war is not an option. We're not ready. All of our resources are being put on domestic reconstruction, rebuilding institutions, and that we don't want, we're also not in the business of making wars. Syrian people don't want wars anymore.
Isn't there a concern, though, that whatever Israel takes, it rarely, almost never, returns back?
I mean, but what options do we have? We have a diplomatic option, we have a military option. The military option, we don't have the capacities. We have very old Russian equipment in the military that needs a lot of mechanics to fix it, and you know, replacing it is very costly. And we have a country that is in ruins. We have a social contract that doesn't exist, and we need to get people to believe in the army, to join the army, and defend the country. And so the whole doctrine of the military doctrine in Syria has shifted towards, you know, preserving territorial integrity, to rebuild the country, and to, you know, kind of minimize the noise that's coming from Israel. We'll continue to demand.
But it's not just a noise, I suppose.
It's land troops occupying Syrian territories. I mean, it is an occupation of Syrian territories. And so we're not going to give up as a country, as a nation, as a people, any you know, centimeter of territory. This is Syrian land. Are we going to go at war with it? Currently, there's no desire by anyone in Syria. You talk to anyone in on the streets. Yes, we hate occupation. Yes, we will never say that this will ever become an Israeli territory.
I heard you say in another interview that Syria is not interested in being the ground for proxy politics anymore. But I suppose more powerful geopolitical players don't always ask for opinions of smaller ones. And given these increasing tensions in the region, as well as between Turkey and Israel, we all heard that the Israelis are now increasingly believing that Turkey is their next big enemy. Don't you think that that may create the conditions when your country will once again become a a scene for settling indirect scores, because neither of them is interested in the direct confrontation right now, but clearly the tensions are building.
Well, I think one thing where I'm sure about, the Syrian authorities do not want Syria to become a scene for proxy, you know, wars to be settled. How are we going to go about it? It's not easy. I mean, we're still in a recovery mode, and we need to play very good politics to kind of deter these motives. In a nice way, we're talking about our great relations with Turkey as a strategic partner for Syria. We're also talking about a strategic partnership with Jordan and with the Gulf countries. And so diversifying and balancing relations across countries is a priority for us to make sure that we're not seen as one proxy of one country, but actually a hub of connectivity. When we work on increasing the cost-benefit analysis of Syria becoming a hub for connectivity, then everybody will help us make sure that we're not part of any conflicts, that if any two countries want to resolve issues, they can resolve it outside of Syria, because in Syria, we want connectivity to ports, to highways, to internet, to be a hub for it. And if we want that, we cannot be an area of conflict.
I think the recent attack on Iran has demonstrated to many in the Middle East, particularly the Gulf countries, that development and security alliances cannot be taken for granted. It's pretty clear that you can pay for that very dearly, and it's still unclear whether the Sunni nations will be able to cooperate freely in the region, because apparently Israel believes that it's entitled to controlling or combating any new realignments. How much do you think Syria's future is dependent on the overall structure of the Middle East? And do you think it's... What do you think the region itself, particularly its Sunni actors, are likely to move from now?
I mean, it's a very complex question. If I may talk about the regional approach, I think it's... Everyone's approach now is towards stability, towards connectivity. This is how we can focus on increasing the cost-benefit analysis for goodwill, for and
does it apply to Israel, though?
I mean, it doesn't. Israel will always be the rogue actor. I mean, today we have one rogue actor in the Middle East. Before that, we had Iran, and now at least Iran is out of Syria. It's out of this you know, the crescent, the Shia crescent.
Who is worse? As far as you're concerned, who's more unpredictable?
It's very difficult to say who's worse. I mean, they're both destabilizing actors. At least Iran is back to its borders. Israel is not. Israel continues to aggress on territories around it, and it takes land and it doesn't give it back. And so, there needs to be more pressure by the Russians, by the Americans, by many, to say that this post October 7. Crazy approach of, you know, going beyond borders without any objective, without any security partnership. I mean, Israel is no longer interested in peace agreements. Israel is now in a doctrine of just attacking, killing everybody to make sure that it survives. And that is not sustainable. That's not sustainable even in terms of weapon supplies to all countries in the region. You can't have unlimited weapon supplies. And so at some point, it's going to run out.
Well, I guess time will tell. But for the time being, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.